This podcast is brought to you by LMU Munich.
And thank you, Philip, Martin, Marlin, for inviting me to this very much insightful symposium. And thank you all for getting up early and being awake. I hope I won't sleep you through my presentation. And without further dwelling on these things, I'm going to begin talking about sludge. The 13th of November of 1985, at 10 p.m., the Arenas crater of the Ruiz volcano in Colombia erupted. The outburst provoked a thaw and a mud avalanche that made its way along the riverbeds of the Huali, Azufrado, and Lagunilla rivers in Colombia, traveling east and ending up in the largest river of Colombia, the Magdalena. Along the way, the massive slide of sludge raised the village of Armero in the darkness of the night and scattered entire houses, cars, and bodies through the Magdalena Valley. The avalanche killed more than 25,000 persons, and the magnitude of the devastation was, in Austin Ziederman's words, until then unprecedented. The hot mud that broke through the Cordillera carried away the villagers, stripped them of their clothes, and dispelled them along the avalanche's path. The enlodados, the men of the mud, were nowhere to be found in the following days and appeared startlingly hanging on treetops, holding on to construction scraps and or half buried under the mud. This area around the Ruiz volcano had already witnessed several landslides, avalanches throughout the colonial and republican periods that have marked the landscape, leaving carved trails that today flow smoothly from the high mountains into the valley. And yet these carvings, at first sight, manifest geological traces on the soil, visible, evident, are profoundly elusive and travel beyond the marks on the ground. They also move through bodies, images, and narratives of destruction and wealth that articulate the ways in which the people who live in the valley relate to these, to this landscape and to the residues and buried and unburied materials that dwell, or as I hope to show, transit through the valley. 30 years after the tragedy, the piles of rubble and residue resist, degrade, and even grow into the everyday lives of those who dwell, as well as of those who travel among the ruins. During my fieldwork, a series of travels I realized chasing these residues that escaped me, following the traces of these remains that were far from stable, I wondered how people related to these uncanny, broken, fragmented things. I stumbled my way into hidden vaults, yearning guacas, scraps of train rails, broken machinery from the cotton-producing industry, remains of coffee threshers, a skull with golden teeth, and a trunk full of rotten clothes. These things, I would find, are not bound to stable decay. They migrate through the landscape across junkyards, museums, as brujería spells, or as souvenirs for passing tourists. They follow erratic trajectories that crisscross and intersect with human practice and affect bodies as they pass along the valley. The research I conducted, also erratically following the paths of these residues, wishes to explore how these remains, understood through a meshwork of exchanges, appropriations, and tensions, have engendered a social life that transforms the ways of what Duran, Kingman, Garcés, and Lacarieux have identified as practices of inhabiting the heritage. Ruins and rubble, absence and immobilities. For Theodor Adorno, ruins work as metaphors for his negative dialectics, a philosophical project that intended to show the cracks and conflicts between words and things, between nature and history. Indeed, as Gaston Gordillo has put it, Adorno wished to disintegrate, and I quote here, the positivity of the given, of things as they seem to be, and thereby to undermine any reified fantasy of a complete, seamless whole. Although ruins can effectively evoke rupture, They can also become reified, tamed objects, heritage. Indeed, ruins can also be the result of the positive regrouping of scattered piles of rubble in order to become unitary, coherent vestiges that call for contemplation. As I traveled along the Valley of Armero asking for ruins, almost everybody pointed me towards the few blocks of Armero that still stood in place, abandoned after the avalanche, always disregarding the piles of rubble, broken objects, and remnants that were scattered through the valley. These few blocks of standing houses, tangled with rubber trees and ceibas that grew through old rooms, kitchens, and small yards, were officially declared part of Colombian heritage by 2013. These were actual ruins that had to be recovered from abandonment by the heritage industry in order to become tourist attractions in the middle of this now economically abandoned region. I wish I could dwell more on this, but I can't. These processes of state reincorporation that often end up organizing, preserving, and regrouping the otherwise unruly and unstable world of scattered rubble called for an ethnographic understanding of ruins in terms of production, industry, and actual building sites. As Laura Ann Stoller has put it, ruins are not just found, they are made. "Look at that under your feet, just behind you. Can't you see it?" cried Freddy, the director of the Red Cross of Armero, as he pointed with his finger towards my feet. "It is so rare to find one of these. We must take it before anyone else does," he said. When I finally understood what he was talking about, I saw under my feet an empty bottle of soda. It read La Bogotana. This is an old soda that was only produced in Armero when it still existed. Freddy came up to me and picked it up, putting it in the pocket of his sweaty pants. As we walked through what used to be the main road of the town of Armero in the middle of an unbearably hot and damp afternoon, half-buried buildings loomed out of the ground, standing as the sole survivors of the avalanche. The walls of these abandoned houses were all cracked by the creeping branches of rubber trees, ceibas and samanes, that had overgrown what was left of the old town, growing over decaying piles of rubble and concrete. The unsettling sounds of cicadas rumbling through the cracked walls was a constant reminder that in the midst of all this destruction, life was thriving, as Tim Ingold would say, making its way through the cracks. We were walking slowly, stumbling with our heads low, looking for enormous snail shells that had invaded Armero, scattered in the whole city, and were said to bring good fortune to those who found them. After having walked for a good half hour, still unable to find any shells, Freddy turned towards me and asked me if I wanted to visit his old house. Puzzled at the absurdity of the question, I just nodded and followed him. We walked for another while towards the mountains and stopped at a big house that was just as the others, half buried under the ground. The mud, covered in leaves that cracked under our feet as we walked in, had devoured the house up to mid-height. I followed Freddy through the frames of old doors that still divided, though precariously, the inside and the outside of the house. Freddy stood inside and explained to me through gestures where the living room used to be, the kitchen, and finally his own room. "This was where I used to sleep," he said, pointing towards a small space still enclosed by concrete. Among dry leaves and dirt in the middle of his room, a rubber tree stood tall, climbing through an inexistent roof and reaching what I guessed must have been at least 5 meters high. "What happened to the roofs?" I wondered. "Those were taken by vandals, scrap dealers who have no respect, valancheros, men of the mud," he answered. The absence and the void left by some objects still resonated through the place and showed me how complex and incomplete the process of regrouping and conserving these ruins actually was. In spite of the will to restrain and keep together the fragments of old houses and ruins, the great mobility of some particular fragments that, as I will show, travel not only in the hands of valancheros, but also through the layers of mud moving erratically through the landscape, constantly broke the unity of the ruin as heritage. These remains, piled up and scattered through the fields as marks of a destroyed past, escaped the heritage industry and didn't operate as ruins that call for contemplation. Their vitality lay rather on their capacity to travel through the valley. Remains that weren't part of what Walter Benjamin had called the bourgeois dream world, the world of the spectacle landscape. These residues inhabit the limit between objects and things, or as Freddy would have put it, exist as vainas. Vainas are disintegrated residues that have no form, no unity, no name, and that, as W.J.T. Mitchell has put it, look back at us. I am talking about fragments that migrate through the sludge and blend with residues from colonial times, fragments that were much harder to find and yet tremendously powerful in their capacity to affect the lives of those who live in the Valley of Armero as much as my own. This ability to travel and to scatter the displacement of things is something the people of Armero refer to as the desparpajo of things, hinting towards the unstable life of broken remains in a place where the soil is constantly shifting. This unruly mobility of remains, their incapacity to stay put, related to something that Spinoza understood as a form of material vitality, a tendency to activity, a vital impulse of objects, the conatus. This vitality inherent to movement and fragmentation called for an ethnography on the life of these broken remains and their complex relations with insects, plants, and human beings. I wonder about the trajectories of these residues and their ability to transit through the landscape. So ruins are no longer thought, as Gaston Gordillo would say, as inert and silent objects, but rather perceived through the surprising travels and powers of rubble. In this sense, my fieldwork was always defined by the tension between fleeting remains that lurked in what Kathleen Stewart has evoked as a space on the side of the road, elusive remains that are only visible through their mobility, their absences, and on the other hand, immobile ruins, unitary aesthetic monuments deemed to be conserved and contemplated. What if we admitted that things really can or do hail us, as Jane Bennett would say, that they can participate in transmissions across bodies and offer us a glimpse into a world of swarming living materials that are neither quite objects nor subjects, she wonders. The challenge was, in this sense, to attune to the vibrations, as she calls it, and effects of rubble to things I engage through my travels, through my wanderings, chasing the erratic paths of broken objects that are constantly playing hide and seek, appearing and disappearing in the mud. Instead of thinking of coherent units that act upon the world, the effort lies to me in understanding the distributions of these agencies through transits, migrations, through entanglements of things, plants, animals, and other beings. The need to destabilize the aesthetic unitary concept of the ruin and approach it, as Gaston Gordillo has done, ethnographically through rubble and residues that circulate corresponds to the need to decompose basic notions of subjects and objects, trying to place myself in the borders of these distinctions. Residues, broken things, vinous, are nor fully objects nor fully subjects. They are more like shifting materials that, as Jane Bennett has put it, vibrate. In this sense, I propose a form of montage that, mimicking Walter Benjamin's Constellations, focuses on the ghostly lines, as Tim Engel has put it, that connect these residues and reflect their ability to move through space. Indeed, this ethnography deals much more with transit rather than dwelling, and in this sense understands decay as an unstable process, a very vital one indeed, borrowing on the notion of afterlife that Gordillo has recognized in rubble. I wish then to approach these residues in terms of trajectory, fragmentation, and entanglement. I'm going to talk about scrap. This is a small vignette in the whole map of my work. I wonder why bones last so long. Why does it take so long for bones to disappear? If everything is destroyed 10, 20 years after, everything is destroyed, finished, rotten, and still bones do not rot. That's what puzzles me, said the scrap dealer. I've asked people, why do bones last so long? I've been told that it is because bones are stout and hefty because of all the vitamins inside them. But I don't believe that. If you bury a chunk of iron, you'll see that a year later it will be corroded and fragile. Why is it that bones last so long? As I walked through the town of Guayabal, a small city a few miles up north from the ruins of Armero, where some of the survivors of the avalanche had been relocated 30 years ago, I stumbled upon a particular house that attracted my attention. As the other houses of the small town, it had big doors and windows that allowed for peeking into the residence, but unlike the others, this particular one was surrounded by mounds of metal junk and scrap that sprouted into the streets. Fragments of tractors, washing machines, and unrecognizable chunks of rust and metal emanated out of the front door. I walked up to the front of the house, hailed by these small hills of shrieking metal, and saw a group of men sitting in plastic chairs listening to the radio. As I approached, an old man with an improvised cane slowly stood up from his chair and limped towards me. As we got close enough to one another, the old man introduced himself as the scrap dealer of Armero and asked what I was looking for. As I explained who I was and I told him I was interested in finding residues of Armero, he told me he made his living out of gathering things that burgeoned out of the soil and selling them to tourists or people who had nostalgia for these vinous. As we talked about the things he had found, he guided me through the heaps of metal into his house. Inside, a chaos of multiplying scrap metal greeted me. The kitchen, where the scrap dealer's wife was cooking, was barely recognizable among the piles of bicycle parts, old broken radios, and rusty bolts. Children ran in and out of the sea of metal waste, playing with the small chick that jumped along the scraps. Piled things seemed to accumulate almost by themselves, growing bigger and bigger as we walked deeper into the house. I couldn't stop thinking of Jane Bennett's research on hoarders and the way in which the heaps of accumulated things reveal the powerful agency of things. These mounds of scrap exemplify what she called the thing power, a particular moment in which objects become things and manifest traces of independence or aliveness constituting the outside of our own experience. Indeed, among the piles of unrecognized objects, of scraps of metal that had already rebelled from their names they were once given, I witnessed the liveliness intrinsic, and I quote here, to the materiality of the thing formerly known as an object. I wandered through the scrap dealer's house, enchanted by the uncanny presence of vibrant materials, a place governed by living heaps of things, a place we walked through only as some kind of temporal intruders. I don't know why, he said, looking up at the mounds of metal, his eyes absorbed by the rust and the sharp edges that surfaced. They simply fascinate me, the scrap dealer said. When we then sat down and started talking about residues from Armeru, I found many things of that time, of the time of Armeru. 3 years ago, I was walking around and found a toothpiece with three teeth of gold. It was bien halado, a good job, a pretty good job, he said. Little could I imagine about the residues he was going to talk about. Little did I know about the difference between bone and metal. Just as the metal sprouted that day out of the scrap dealer's house, in 1757, 2.5 centuries earlier, gold sprouted out of the riverbed of the Coelho River, a few miles south of the town of Guayabal. Fray Juan de Santa Gertrudis, a Spanish friar, walked through the dense valley of the Magdalena River towards the southern end of what is now Colombia, the Putumayo region. As he traveled along the Magdalena River, he wrote about the troubles with the wild indios near the Coelho River who resisted the Spaniards. As rough as the mountains they dwelled in, the indios had resisted the Spanish efforts to conquer their land. The ferocity of the savages, in his words, was, in the friar's account, due to the incredible amount of gold that was to be found up in these mountains. In fact, there was so much gold that the Spanish settlers would search in the stream of the Coelho River for gold riches that migrated along the water from the high mountains towards the safe lowlands. The scrap dealer had not only found many things in Armeru, he had also lost much during the night of November 13th, 1985, the night of the avalanche. He had found the toothpiece in the sludge of the avalanche, but the sludge had also taken his house and his belongings away from him. It was terrible, he said, referring to the night of the tragedy. The sludge had snatched a small girl from his arms, a girl he never saw again. And yet the scrap dealer told me that he came back to Armeru as soon as he could after the disaster. 4 months after the avalanche, having recovered from his wounds, he returned to Armeru in search of buried remains, anything that he could gather and sell. This made me think of the sludge that had raised an entire city and at the same time had fertilized the land and soon became an epicenter for people in search of buried riches and good fortune. However, the sludge had stirred the land to the extent that it had not only covered and displaced the belongings of the people of Armeru and its people, but it also displaced the remains of colonial structures and vestiges from what they call ancient times. As the scrap dealer told me later on, these residues were not only capable of hiding in the mud and appearing only to those worthy of gold fortune, they could also enchant and bewitch and curse people who wandered in the search of these lively remains. After showing me the golden teeth he had mentioned earlier, the scrap dealer told me about a time he ventured into Armeru with a friend, looking for scraps or anything that would be of some worth, and found an envuelto, a wrapping. This is a form of treasure, again, that is wrapped and hidden. A skull surfaced out of the mud, he said. It was one of the skulls that had been disturbed by the avalanche high up in the mountains and ended up in the lowlands in Armeru. He told me the skull had a piece of gold carved into the nose. The gold was roughly encrusted into the bone. It wasn't smooth. I could tell it was handmade, so it had to be the skull of an Indio, he said. The gold was rugged like my skin, so it had to come from El Monte, from the mountains. He said, as he described the golden nose piece, the gold was inserted into thick bone, not on cartilage. It was very big, very elegant. Facing the resistance of the Indios, Friar Juan relates to how the conflict between Spaniards and the Indios was stoked by the presence of gold that not only emanated from the riverbeds, but also was seen to be carried by the indigenous people who were sporadically spotted by the settlers. It seems that these Indios, as the Friar Juan refers to them, would wear distinctive nose pieces of gold that they drilled up into their nasal bones. In his words, Doña Gregoria, told me she had found at the margins of the Coelho River a golden nose piece that weighed 3 ounces. I was then told that these Indios are known to wear golden nose pieces as what he calls badges, and that they savagely drill them into their noses. I hear they are made of very shiny, thick gold, he writes. A German gentleman offered me a good deal of money for that skull, continued the scrap dealer as we talked. He wanted to offer it to his daughter. They had come in search for treasures of Armero, just like you, he told me. Jeez, as he pointed his finger towards me. Those Germans offered me 500,000 pesos. That's not much. but that skull had been what, I asked. A few weeks after settling a price for the skull, I turned to a small plantation I have near Armero, he said. I went there during the night because I thought it would rain, and in the morning I wanted to plant the fields. I'll tell you what happened. Around 11 o'clock, nos asustaron. They frightened us. A strong sulfur scent invaded the air. It was sickening. It wasn't the first time I heard of places that asustan, following Gordillo, places that scare people as they pass by, of those devils that lurk among the rubble of destroyed places, and as the scrap dealer said, uncovered the earth. How do you mean a sulfur scent? I asked him. I was terrified, he replied. I fled the fields and thought, this is the devil. Who knows what kind of devil? As he got home, the scrap dealer picked up the skull and left towards the fields of Armero. He buried the skull, for it, in his words, it didn't want to be sold. We couldn't do business with it. It needed to return to the mud. Indeed, the skull had awoken the devils that cracked the earth open. Skulls, fragmented bodily remains that embody the negativity of the violence of the conquista, lurk among the mud, stalking those who dwell on the surface, casting curses and embrujos. In fact, the scrap dealer told me he was still embrujado, haunted by the skull. In a very particular way, they sell it, I am still pisado, which means I am still stepped on by the skull. Enchanted, he said. This is where I finish, basically. Thank you very much. Oh, I completely forgot. So just to finish, the whole ethnography works actually like a connection of vignettes that have different ways of relying and of relating to each other in very conflicting ways, actually. And this that I just read was on scrap that is actually here. And the whole ethnography works on connections between these vignettes and different objects that conflict between each other, so to speak, between tourism, witchcraft, and...